Blog Talk Radio.
The voice that brightens up my every Tuesday morning. At least the Tuesdays we actually hear her voice. That's great. Good morning, everybody. This is Jeffrey Swartz. Yeah, I forgot who I was for a second there. This is Jeffrey Swartz. I am a professor of law at Cooley Law School's Tampa Bay campus, and I'm here with my colleague, Brendan Berry, who happens to be, guess what, a professor of law at Cooley Law School's Tampa Bay campus. And before we go any further, I have to say that the opinions that each of us render are ours and ours alone. They are not necessarily the opinions of the administration of Cooley Law School and or its faculty, either at large or individually. And good morning, Brendan.
Hunter Biden's laptop.
Hunter Biden's laptop. We got to get it a little bit deeper. I know that's not in your DNA. It's not in mine either. Okay? Not in your repertoire. Hunter Biden's laptop. We're going to talk about that in a minute. And how irrelevant it truly is. Okay?
Yeah.
But before we do that, we have to say good morning to Hezzy, our patron, friend,
good morning,
our
good
benefactor.
Morning.
Yeah, good morning, Hezzy. You sound wonderful this morning. It's good to talk to you.
Thanks.
Okay.
Always a pleasure.
Good to hear you in my ear. Oh, it's always good to hear you in my ear. Normally, we talk about what do we really think, but there's all kinds of breaking news this morning. I mean, we get to talk about something that is so current, okay, that the presses haven't even started rolling on it yet, okay? So hold the presses. A couple of items. Aileen Cannon, obviously having been, she's being tutored by an experienced judge, that's very obvious, entered three orders in the past week since we talked. The first one was that she told all of the lawyers representing Donald Trump to, by last Friday, they had to fill out their application for a security clearance so that they could view the documents and the discovery, and we could start the discovery process. And they were told that they had to be in by the 20th of June, which is, I guess, what, how many days? It's today is the 20th of June. Okay, they were they had their applications had to be in today. And the Department of Justice and the FBI have agreed that they're going to clear these people within 3 weeks so that they can start looking at the classified documents. But in the meantime, they can start looking at the non-classified documents. The problem is that Donald doesn't have a trial lawyer yet representing him. Who's applying for the security clearance? I don't know. Third base. Okay? And who's applying for a security clearance for Walt Nauta? I don't know. Probably going to be the federal public defender, and many of them already have security clearances. Isn't that wonderful? Okay. And so despite all of this, she also entered an order against Donald and warned him that he is not allowed to talk about anything he learns from discovery, any of the documents that he gets in discovery, classified or otherwise. And the next step eventually is going to tell him to keep his mouth shut, which he won't listen to because we found that out last night on Fox News with Brett Baer. Yay, Brett Baer. Okay, we'll talk about that before the day's out. And lastly, half an hour ago, she filed an order setting a trial date in this case for August 14th. Now, before you start applauding, let me hold back here. Let me hold you back. Okay, Marilyn, I know you're all excited. Hold a minute here. Okay. What's happening here is that there's a statutory 70-day speedy trial rule in federal court. And in order to avoid...
Hey, Jeff.
Jeff,
before you continue, I don't know if Hezzy's having the same problem, but you sound a little distant.
I'm having trouble hearing you very well.
Yeah.
Is it a little better now?
Yeah, that's
it. It is for me. Yes.
Okay. It was the position of my microphone. I'm sorry. Thank you for telling me that. Yep, okay. No problem. There is a statutory speedy trial rule in the federal law that says that you're entitled to a speedy trial within 70 days of your arraignment. 70 days. Or your indictment. I'm sorry, your indictment. If you are from the date you're arrested on your indictment, whatever it is, your surrender, whatever, when the case actually starts. And this date that she has set is within that 70 days. The idea is that you're forcing the defendant, who is never going to be ready by August 14th, to move for a continuance. And that takes it outside of that. And then she can grant all the continuance that he wants or she wants to give him. So this case is not going to trial on the 14th. Never going to happen. This is all statutory compliance stuff. So relax. This case will, it's still possible. She can push this case to trial by the end of the year. But let's not get excited about that either, because she still has the power to cripple the government's cases based upon motions that are filed and may try to make new law in some of this area, because the law is dead set against him on almost, literally on all of them. Okay, and she could, at the end of the government's case, grant a judgment of acquittal. There is no appeal from that. He is acquitted, and the case is over. And that's kind of a problem. But if she did that, her place in history would be about a half a step behind Donald Trump's. And her children will grow up with people saying, oh, your mother is that judge who let Donald Trump go, and she shouldn't have. Okay, but she's a disgrace to the – she would be a disgrace to the judiciary if she did that. So I don't think he's going to get a judgment of acquittal out of her. But she may give him some rulings that'll cripple Jack's case. May not be enough, but she's going to try. So that's the news on Donald, although we have other things to talk about on him as we go on. The second piece of news, here's something that there's a guy from Ohio. He's in Congress. He rolls up his sleeves all the time. His hair is on fire right now. And it's not about Hunter Biden's laptop. Hunter Biden has agreed to plead to an information to be filed against him in federal court for two misdemeanor federal tax charges. And on the third charge, which is in connection with possession of a firearm by a person who is a user or addict of illegal drugs, he's going to be placed in a pretrial diversion program, which means eventually that charge will be dismissed. The U.S. attorney that had been assigned to do this, a guy by the name of David Weiss, he was a Donald Trump appointee who was selected as basically a special prosecutor. By the way, David Weiss is from Delaware. Who else do we know that's from Delaware? The Bidens. David Weiss, who was the Republican U.S. attorney in Delaware, who was appointed to investigate these matters involving Hunter Biden, has entered into this agreement. It should be noted that Mr. Weiss, his charge as a special prosecutor was never terminated by Merrick Garland, never interfered with by Merrick Garland. Joe Biden could have fired him. Joe Biden did not fire him. And he remains the U.S. attorney for the state of Delaware, despite the fact that he is a Trump appointee and he is a Republican. So right now there are people on the Judiciary Committee that are already drafting the subpoena to haul his ass in and explain why he let him off with two misdemeanors and a pretrial diversion program. I guess they think that Hunter Biden taking pictures of his own not-so-private parts, okay, anymore, is a crime. What happened to Burisma? What happened to all the other stuff? And Weiss is going to come in and say, I don't know what you're talking about. There's no evidence to support those charges. No evidence whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And we investigated. That's what he's going to say.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, they basically, for all intents and purposes, Hunter Biden is going to get his punishment. And, you know, I got a feeling they're going to be angry because he didn't get enough. He should go to prison for the rest of his life. He's a traitor. And that's the next thing we're going to hear. So that's what's happening with Hunter Biden. I'm not going to worry about his laptop. I'm really not. I mean, you know, so, you know, I didn't know taking pictures of your own private parts is a crime. But apparently the Republicans think it is. So we'll see what happens. There's nothing else on there worthwhile, apparently, because everybody's looked at it anyway. Mm-hmm. So be that as it may, that's the latest stuff. What do you got to start the program with? I had nothing. Go ahead.
No, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Every time the Republicans decide that there needs to be an investigation of a Democrat, how little comes up. I mean, it's just, I don't know when they're going to figure this out, right? They want to investigate Hillary Clinton. You know, they had her in front of a hearing for 11 hours. Remember that? Answering questions about Benghazi. I mean, they turned every rock over that they could find. There's nothing there. Their conspiracies don't make any sense. That's one of the things about if you're going to have a conspiracy theory, you know, it should make a little bit of sense. You know, their theory about Benghazi was that Hillary Clinton intentionally had a U.S. ambassador or allowed a U.S. ambassador to get killed while she was Secretary of State. Now, Republicans, stop and ask yourself, does that make any sense? Why would she do that? Why would the Secretary of State say, I know what'll really help my professional career. I'll get a U.S. ambassador killed while I'm the Secretary of State. It doesn't
that'll
make any
me
sense.
Famous.
Yeah.
That'll make me famous.
Yeah. I mean, she issued a stand down order because she wanted him to die. I mean, what are these people talking about? What are they thinking? And, you know, we've talked about this a lot. You know, you watch Donald Trump, and I know we're going to get to it a little while, but you listen to this guy talk. All you have to do is listen to him talk for a few minutes. To get the sense of what a monster this is, a sociopath, just the lies and the animosity. You'd think you're talking to the devil for crying out loud. And then you look over at Joe Biden, a kind-hearted guy. He gives out his personal phone number to people who stutter, little kids, so that he can help them. He talks to people respectfully. Yeah, he can get a little grumpy once in a while when somebody's, you know, needling him mercilessly. But he's a kind, decent person, right? So these efforts to say, you know, he's the head of some crime family. isn't the irony is so rich? People who support Trump are trying to paint Biden as the head of a crime family, right? It just doesn't make any sense to anybody with eyes and ears. Who can hear this guy and watch the way he operates.
The tone of even Lindsey Graham. What did Lindsey Graham say once? That no one in their right mind would have anything bad to say about Joe Biden.
Right.
And all of a sudden now, because he's on the verge of getting indicted himself, he's screaming and yelling and spitting into the wind what a bad guy Joe Biden is, that his family's a crime family. I mean, all these people who thought Joe Biden was just the salt of the earth, you couldn't say a bad thing about the guy. I don't have to agree with him on – I mean, Republicans are saying, listen, he's too liberal for me. But you can't say anything bad about him as a person. Now all of a sudden they're all jumping on him because George Jim Jordan is. All of a sudden, that makes it okay. I mean, seriously? Give me a break.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I can't accept that. I just literally, can't accept there's any sincerity in the things that they're saying at all.
No, no.
Yeah. So.
No. And yeah.
Okay.
And
so,
all that sense. And supposedly Hunter was the linchpin of the criminal enterprise. And
he was the
capo.
Yeah, he was the capo.
Yeah.
He's the guy.
Yeah.
He's the one. He was the guy who went out and said, "I'm going to bust your kneecaps if you don't give me money."
Right. Right. They've investigated him. As I'm glad you pointed out, it's a Trump appointee who's investigated this guy since 2018, and they've come up with two misdemeanor failure to pay taxes, and a gun violation.
To.
So yeah, right.
No, these are all things he's admitted to.
Yeah,
and this is why. Remember, we talked about the fact that Joe Biden had said in an interview that he was proud of his son Hunter.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Everybody jumped on him. He's a criminal. Of course you're proud of him. He made you millions of dollars, you know, all that kind of crap. Okay. I'm sitting here looking at it, and I'm saying, you know, if it were my son, and my son came home and said, "Dad, I'm in trouble. I'm hooked on drugs. I'm doing stupid stuff. Okay. I think I've committed some crimes. Okay, I really got to get myself straightened out." And he does. And in the process, admits to all of the things that eventually he pled guilty to. They didn't need to investigate. Just go with what he told them. I mean, they didn't have to investigate anything. They backed it up. They go to the IRS. He's paying off some of these back taxes. He's entered into an agreement to pay. It's a misdemeanor. Okay, you don't charge him with a felony for this. It's a failure to pay. It's not fraud. It's just failure to pay. And he straightens himself out. He's not hooked on drugs anymore. And am I proud of him for what he's done to right up his life? Absolutely. He has every reason to be proud of Hunter, who is taking control of his life after the absolute disaster it was for maybe every year since his brother died. You got to be proud of a guy that can do that. So I don't think he was saying he was proud of him for doing the bad stuff. He's proud of him for admitting to the bad stuff that he did. He never fought this investigation. He never hid. There was no need to issue search warrants. There was no obstruction of justice. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm getting into the wrong case. There was none of those things. Absolutely none of those things happened. So, yeah, if I'm his father, I'm going, "You did the right thing, son. I'm proud of you for standing up and admitting your mistakes."
Yeah.
So,
that's, the White House has already issued a pitch-perfect statement saying that the president, first lady, loved their son and will continue to support him as he rebuilds his life. We will have no further comment. That's the end of it.
Wow.
That's smart.
And I can see Jim Jordan saying, okay, he's sober, he's taking care of him. He's going to rebuild his life by making more money for the Biden crime family. That's the statement you're going to get from Jim Jordan. Or whatever his name is. It's the head of the Oversight Committee. I forgot his name begins with an M. Okay. That's what they're going to say. Oh, that's the guy that has the tape recording of the Bidens talking about it because some informant said he talked to a guy who said he had tape, and it just so happens that guy may be Russian, and all of a sudden the whistleblower they had doesn't exist. We don't.
Right.
He had to come back and say, "Well, the tape may not really exist, but I got my 2 cents worth by accusing him of all of that and saying there was a tape. No one's going to remember that I said later on, well, maybe there's not a tape. They're just going to remember I said there was a tape." Please help me.
You know who else's hair is on fire and who's already on social media? Take a wild guess. Who's already?
Donald has something to say. They indicted me. They want to put me in prison. But Hunter Biden's getting away with this. Okay,
yeah,
well, that's probably the way he wrote it because he can't spell. But
yeah,
I gotta find this. I got to find this. It's time for a laugh. It's time for a laugh. This stuff is so laughable. We're going to talk about that. Like last night's interview. We're going to talk about last night's interview.
Yeah.
Okay.
It went something along the lines of, after all the years of crime this family's committed, he's getting away with a traffic ticket. He said something along those lines. he's
Donald
just going
doesn't
nuts.
Get traffic tickets. Yeah, Hunter Donald Trump does not get traffic tickets because he doesn't know how to drive a car.
Right.
I don't think he's driven himself anywhere since he was a teenager.
Right.
And even then, I'm not sure he did. I don't even know if he has a driver's license. Be interesting to find out, wouldn't it?
Yeah. You know, it's just got to drive him nuts. This, you know, Hunter Biden
is not.
Oh,
James Comer is the guy who's talking.
James
Comer.
Hunter
the guy
Biden is not going
about.
To jail.
Yeah, he's not going to jail.
Yeah, and Donald Trump is, and it's driving him nuts.
But according to the charges, Hunter Biden did not commit a felony.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still waiting for the IRS suggestion that Donald Trump did.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't seen it yet, so I can't say it's coming.
Yeah.
Okay. But you know, I can't find it. I don't know where you got that. Was it on
CNN? I just saw it.
It
flashed up on the television. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. That's why I can't. I'm looking at it. Okay. So that's a good segue into the wonderful world of Donald.
Yeah.
Okay. Fantasy land. Okay. I mean, maybe that's why DeSantis filed against him, because, you know, he doesn't like Fantasyland. He doesn't like Disney. He doesn't like Donald.
Right.
He doesn't like anybody that, you know, engages in that conduct. You saw the clips, right?
Yes.
Yes. And I saw more than the clips.
I
woke
saw
up
the whole
this morning
thing.
At 6 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
I heard about some of it last night, and I kind of took a long look at a good portion of that interview. Okay.
Yeah.
And is it fair to say that this guy is, like, deranged?
Oh, God, yes.
And I looked at him. He did not look well.
Right.
He didn't have that glint in his eye that he usually does.
Mm-hmm.
And it may have been a function of Brett Baer, who we thought would give him softball questions and got into his craw at every possibility.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, I have to say, yay, Brett Baer. He did the interview that Caitlin Collins should have done.
Right.
And when you put those two interviews side by side, you can tell the experienced journalist and someone whose star is rising, but not necessarily because she's a really good journalist. She's getting it. She's new. She's young. Okay. She has things to learn. She got pushed around Sunday when she interviewed the chairperson of the Republican National Party. I can't remember her name right now. Got pushed around for 15 minutes. That every question she answered, this chairperson just went back to her talking points, attacking Democrats, not answering the questions. Caitlin would try to interrupt her, and this woman would talk over her. And she would not stand up to her. Caitlin would get about 5 words out and then shut up and let her talk. It was an embarrassment. And now we know why the town hall got out of control and that Donald took over and owned the stage. And Caitlin she was tough when she's in a gaggle. She's tough when she's questioning the president's spokesperson. She can shout out a question with the best of them covering the White House. But I'm beginning to believe that she is there because of the reputation she built at the White House and a couple of other things in reporting, but not necessarily is she an interviewer. I don't think she's strong enough yet. And she's now got a reputation that she can be pushed around. And they need to send her back to the morning program. I don't think she belongs where she is at 9 o'clock, prime time, CNN evenings. Because I've watched some of the interviews there, and they are not strong interviews. They are entertainment interviews in the context that she's trying to provide entertainment as opposed to really getting into people. And she tries to take cheap shots at them, cheap in the context that when they get done talking, she makes a statement, a quick three-second blurb arguing with them, and moves on to another subject and doesn't give them a chance to answer.
Mm-hmm.
Confront them with the truth and make them answer. Don't just make a statement and move on to another. You're not there for a debate. You're there to interview. So I was really disappointed. But Brett Baer got into Donald's craw at every turn. And I think the best of all of that is when Brett started questioning Donald about the people that he had hired and said, you said you were going to hire the best people. And then goes down the list of the people that now he said were the best who are saying he shouldn't be president anymore. He's irresponsible. He should never see secret information ever again. He's a narcissist. He's a baby. He's a child. He's guiltier than hell. This is of all of his own making. Nobody came after him. There's no witch hunt here. And we're talking about people like Esper at the Department of Defense. We're talking about Bill Barr. When did Bill Barr become the voice of reason? Somebody explain this to me. Probably one of the worst attorney generals, at least in my life, since John Mitchell. Okay? I know you have no idea who John Mitchell is. It doesn't matter.
I remember.
You do remember him?
I remember John Mitchell.
Okay. Yeah, you got to be our age, Hezzy, to know who John Mitchell was. Okay. He went after Milley, who he sung the praises of, but what a wonderful guy he's going to be. Milley is now a nothing burger because Milley wouldn't use the military to help Donald Trump overthrow the government.
Mm-hmm.
Mad Dog Mattis. He's no mad dog. He's a schnauzer, okay? Couldn't beat up on anything, okay? He's terrible. He's awful. He was overrated. Chief of staff. Okay, what's his name? Kelly, and the one who was the congressman, the name begins with an M, the Irishman. He probably says that, the Irishman. They're incompetent. They don't know what they're doing. They don't understand Washington like Donald understands it. They were weak. Pompeo said that Donald knows nothing about foreign affairs except for women who come from outside the United States. Okay. Basically says that the guy he has no business being president. Tillis, who he touted as being, he's going to be brilliant. He knows how to deal with Russia. Okay. Made deals with Russia. He's going to be a great Secretary of State. Knew nothing about foreign affairs, and he had no business being the Secretary of State, even though I'm the one that put him there. This is how this interview went. Brett Baer says this to him, and his answer is, well, this time around, I know who the good people are, and I know who the bad people are. And you had a comment about good and bad. What is it about the way he says things that you said?
He's got a second grade vocabulary. It's one of the reasons, you know, when you listen to him talk about people, I'll never forget listening to an interview of his or just a statement he was making where he was talking about somebody he didn't like. And he says, she wasn't very nice. She wasn't very nice to me.
Yeah, that's what he just said.
Very nice.
She wasn't very
like,
nice to me.
Who,
he wasn't.
Who talks like
nice
that? I mean, I don't think I've said a, I don't think I have uttered a sentence like that since I was four. But that's the way he talks. And you know, when you're trying to appeal to people who also speak in, you know, second grade vocabularies, you know, that, I guess that's appealing.
Second grade, not after,
yeah,
towards the end of their second grade year when they right enter second grade.
No, right. Yeah, entering. Yeah, right. Right.
I mean, but the most important thing that happened is that Jack Smith just took about 5 or 6 people off of his witness list and replaced it with this interview.
Right.
Ladies and gentlemen, the defendant. Okay. There's, it turns on the tape. Okay. You're commenting on his right to remain silent. No, I'm not. I'm putting him on himself because this is what he said. And these are statements against interest. So sit down, counsel, and shut up and learn something. Okay? I wanted to do that so bad a couple of times as a prosecutor. I wanted, and I tried to do it as a defense attorney. When I got an objection from the defense, I wanted to go overruled. But I wasn't the judge anymore.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. So it's one of those things where he's being asked questions by Brett Baer about simply, why didn't you just give him the boxes back? Why did you do all of this? I mean, just give them back. You had a chance to get off this. I didn't want to. I was very busy, okay? I didn't have time to go through all of those boxes, and I wanted to go through all those boxes and get all my personal stuff out of those boxes because I had all sorts of things in there. I had golf shirts, clothing, pants, shoes, okay, mixed in with classified information, of course. That's what I do to cover up a classified information. I put clothes on top of it. That's real spycraft, by the way. Okay.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. He said when he was asked exactly why he kept all this sensitive material in the first place, he says, I don't say I do. I didn't actually keep that stuff. And as for the classified Pentagon document, you know, remember, Trump was on tape saying he acknowledged, I have classified information in my hand. See? Mm-hmm. I got it in my hand. Okay? But I can't show it to you. It's a secret. Secret. And I could declassify this when I was president, but I'm not president anymore. So I can't show it to you. But I got it. Look, see what I got? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Mine. Okay? You know, the ring. He says, I didn't have any document per se, claiming the papers he had were newspapers and magazine articles. Who has hundreds of boxes of newspaper articles about themselves and fake covers from Time Magazine Man of the Year? Okay? He said that he never had an Iran attack plan. It was never in the boxes of documents that I know of. Well, how would he know? He didn't have time to go through the boxes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And he says he doesn't know anything about the supposed conversation he had in Bedminster, which was recorded when he talked to his former chief of staff, and Mark Meadows, people who were going to write a book for Mark Meadows.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't know anything about that. He doesn't know anything about that conversation. It was less than a year ago, but he doesn't know anything about it.
And imagine, this is just unbelievable, right? He doesn't know anything about the conversation, but he does know what he had in his hand during the conversation.
Yeah, that never existed. Mm-hmm. That document never existed. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
No, I remember what I had in my hand, but
I got a war plane here.
Right. Yeah. It's just unbelievable, the contradiction.
Oh, I mean, seriously. And I know what the defense is going to say. Well, that's basically calling the defendant as a witness against himself, as an adverse witness. And the answer is no. He's not under oath. These are just – he says these things all over the country. What are you talking about? I'm putting on his own statement. You make this is an exception to that called a statement against interest, a statement against pecuniary interest. What the hell are you talking about? You know, I think I would go crazy as the other side. Judge, you can't honestly believe that stuff. I got a rule of evidence. Do I have to show it to you? I mean,
you never know.
This trial is going to be such a circus. Yeah. I mean, it's going to be a circus. It's going to be an absolute circus. And it's going to be up to the government to keep control over that courtroom because Aileen Cannon can't do it. Okay? She can't. So, I mean, seriously. Let's see. What are we talking about? This weekend, the Attorney General of the United States, former Attorney General, Bill Barr, everybody wants to interview. He's a very popular guy, at least for the moment. Okay? When he first left, nobody wanted to talk to this guy. He was like Typhoid Mary. I don't even want him in the same room with me. Okay? Now everybody wants to. He's on Face the Nation on Sunday. He starts on Fox. He starts going after Donald on Fox. All of a sudden, everybody else now wants to talk to him. So he's on Face the Nation. He calls Trump a defiant 9-year-old. Okay? And that was his comparison. He says, if true, the conduct we're talking about was a flagrant crime that cannot be excused. He wrote that in an op-ed for the Free Press. He says, no one is above the law. And then it's followed up with Mark Esper, who we mentioned earlier, who said that the revelations in the indictment jeopardize national security. Although he was careful enough to add if the allegations are true. Oh, yeah, by the way, if the allegations are true. Okay.
Yeah.
And he says, this is the quote, if the allegations are true that it contained information about our nation's security, about our vulnerabilities, about other items, it could be quite harmful to the nation in an irresponsible action. That's Mark Esper.
Mm-hmm.
No one is above the law. And asked whether he could be trusted with the nation's secrets again, based on his actions, again, if proven true under the indictment by special counsel, the answer is no. Think he's going to get a security clearance for his trial? I mean, you know, he went after Mattis. I mean, he's gone after everybody. He's gone after Mike Pence. And Pence, the coward that he is, the absolute sycophant of all sycophants, can never really come down on this guy because he says it's premature to reach conclusions. Okay. Well, listen to him talk. Why do you have to worry about the allegations? Just listen to what the man has to say.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't reach a judgment on that? The truth of the matter is that Smith doesn't even have to put a case on. And Trump keeps saying it's an unfair prosecution. Jim Jordan, who maintains Trump's innocence, says for all of that he says, and I don't care, it attacks Bill Barr. And he says, I don't think they're actually defending his conduct, but they are saying it's unfair to prosecute him. So, you know, supposedly that's what they're saying. I don't know. He sits there and says, I have the right to have these documents. The Presidential Record Act says so. How many times have I explained, even right here, how the Presidential Records Act actually works?
Mm-hmm.
Those records should have never left the White House. They should have never been put in a box. They should have never been put in a moving van. They belong to the archives as of January 20th, and even before January 20th, he had no right to remove them from the White House.
Mm-hmm.
And he does have the right to go through them after the archives have gone through them. That's what they have the right to do. So, you know, and I've done this before, I'll do it again. First of all, Donald doesn't have a security clearance. Most presidents have a specialized kind of security clearance that when the president, the sitting president, wants them to see something, he has the authority to send it down to them and based upon this special security clearance to see things. When the archivist takes control and has them under lock and key and sets them up in a place near where the former president is and the former president asks to see certain records, they're brought to them in a by a military guy with one of those briefcases handcuffed to their arm. And he opens up the briefcase, and he gives it to the former president, and he has to stay right there with the former president while the former president reads it. And if the former president takes notes, the guy who brought it to him has to look at the notes and make sure that nothing that's in the notes discloses information which should not be disclosed from the document. And then he takes the document back, and he takes it back to the archive, and he puts it away. They don't get to keep it. They don't get to lock it up in their house. None of that stuff takes place. They read it. It's taken away from them, and back it goes. But Donald gets 2 years to hold on to these documents completely unsecured because he has to find the shirts and the shoes and the pants and everything else that he's put in there, that he put in with these very sensitive documents, because that's what you do. You have these boxes filled with documents that you have created, these boxes you created with documents that you ordered to be held onto, boxes that you traveled around the country with, like mine, I'm going to take it with me wherever I go. Okay, if he's going to China, he takes secret documents about China on a box on Air Force One with him. Okay, he's like attached to them. Okay, he's got to have a box of documents with him. Okay, and he doesn't understand. You don't stick your golf shoes in there. And then say, well, the box has, he covers them up with his clothes and things like that. Says, oh, this just has some of my golf clothes in it. Your golf clothes are very heavy, like you. That's the way it works. And he's sitting there excusing it, saying, I had the right to have them, and I don't even think I had any classified documents. Okay, but if I did, they're mine. And I can have them, and I declassified everything, although there's no document, anything to show that he really did declassify them, and he denied that he declassified them on tape. I mean, the guy is, I don't understand. And Barr said, the best quote he said was, our country can't be a therapy session for, you know, yeah, a troubled man like this.
Right.
Seriously. We're all this guy's therapist. Okay. I thought that was a great line. Did you hear that line?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Before? Oh, it's a great line. So yep. I don't know what you do. Yeah, you go ahead. You say what you want to say about this, because I could go on all day about it. Yeah, awful. Oh, just awful.
Yeah, it is. It's well, and you talk about an entering second grade vocabulary. I mean, I saw that quote too. When he tells the lawyer, those are mine. Those are my boxes. I don't want you to look at my boxes.
Nobody can look at my boxes.
Yeah. I don't want anyone to look at my boxes. I don't want you to look at my boxes. They're mine. I'm like, who talks like that?
I just got, you know, you see two little kids playing, right? One of them's got a toy.
Yeah.
And the other one comes over and says, that's my toy.
Okay. Right.
No, it's not. It's my toy. Okay.
Right.
I just want to play with it.
Right.
But you can't play with my toy.
No, no. It's mine. I don't want you to take my toy. No.
I see my 4-year-old grandson do that with his 2-year-old brother. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
It's my toy. We'll let him play with it for a while. No, it's my toy. Okay.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. Yeah, we're both praying to the same God, I hope. Oh, just help me. Literally, help. Okay. Absolutely awful. I mean, I just... I can't imagine even Aileen Cannon being able to help this guy at trial. Honest to goodness.
Mm-hmm.
I really can't imagine it. So it's okay. We have to talk about, you know, like stuff that involves the courts. And because there have been some decisions that came down. And I don't think we talked last week about the case out of Alabama, which is, I want to get the exact name, Allen versus Milligan, which had to do with redistricting. You know about the case, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Why don't you explain it, and then we'll talk about it.
It's kind of a follow-on to a case called Citizens United, which was a bad harbinger for what the court might do in this case, in the Alabama case. In Citizens United, the Supreme Court, per Justice Roberts, wrote the opinion, struck down Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act as unconstitutional. Section 5 was the part of the Voting Rights Act that required preclearance before certain jurisdictions, and you know, you can imagine what jurisdictions we're talking about, mostly what are now called red states.
Start Arkansas,
we're not allowed,
Texas, and wrap around the South, and you've got it.
Yeah. And the Section 5 said that those states, with obviously the states that had a history of racial discrimination and in their voting practices, were not allowed to change the, you know, in any material way to change the voting rules without the Department of Justice giving them the go-ahead to do it. So that was really, you know, that had teeth. You know, these jurisdictions that have a history of messing around and taking away people's right to vote on the basis of race or ethnicity, just were not able to change the rules without neutral people saying, okay, that's an all right change. The Supreme Court struck that down, essentially declaring that the problem of racism is over in America. Even though the Constitution says that Congress is allowed to enforce the Equal Protection Clause through appropriate legislation, it actually says that right there, that the court didn't think this was appropriate anymore. It has to be appropriate legislation. And now that racism is not a problem in this country anymore, you know, that's not appropriate anymore. Talk about a naive ruling. So, incidentally, when you look at the jurisdictions that changed that began to change their voting rules immediately after Citizens United, and lay it over the map of jurisdictions that were under Section 5 preclearance, the two maps lined up almost perfectly. It was the same jurisdiction.
Like the consumer cellular map matches up with Verizon's in the advertisements.
Yeah, right. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a different color.
Yeah. That's right. That's exactly. I mean, that's exactly
white,
the jurisdiction.
One is white. Yeah, one is white. One is white and black. Okay.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
Right.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Chocolate.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Chocolate. Yeah. The exact jurisdictions that they said you can't change the rules because we know you're up to no good. They started changing the rules immediately when the court said they could. So needless to say, that kind of leads into the Alabama case, which was about Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which still requires that that states not, at least they can't get caught changing their voting rules based on their preferred racial voters. It looks like Roberts and I know you have some stuff to say about this, but Roberts and Kavanaugh have changed their tune. We were really waiting for the court just to strike down Section 2 and say that's not appropriate anymore either, but they upheld it and applied it to Alabama in a way that's going to make Ron DeSantis' life a little more difficult. So why don't you take it from there and talk a little bit more about Ron DeSantis.
The case actually deals with the idea that Alabama had gerrymandered out of existence districts that were basically created to give a one-man, one-vote kind of representation for black communities instead of chopping them up into little pieces into other districts where their votes would mean absolutely nothing, destroying their vote power. The court said no. Where you can create districts that will give equal representation for an ethnic or a racial balance based upon the totality of the population of the state, without gerrymandering, going to great gyrations to gerrymander such a district, they should do that. And it's a one man, one vote, equal protection kind of thing. And that's what Alabama had done. It gerrymandered out of existence black representation in Congress for black people who lived in Alabama. Now, this wasn't the only state in the 11th Circuit. This is an 11th Circuit case that had done that. The state of Florida did it. Alabama tried to justify it based upon their promise not to gerrymander it, and they showed their map and said, "See, we didn't go to great gyrations." But that's not what we did in Florida. In Florida, we passed a map that did that. The courts overruled it. They had to come up with a new map for the 2022 election. So the legislature came up with a new map that kind of comported with what the courts kind of indicated they were supposed to do, that did not take aim at two black districts in the state of Florida, one in Orlando, which was Val Demings' district, and the other one in the panhandle, and I can't remember the guy, the congressman who had that district, who had been there for like 10 or 12 years out of that district in the panhandle, also African-American. And the governor, DeSantis, vetoed that. And the legislature literally threw up their arms and just said, "Tell us what you want, and we'll pass it." And so they did. And he came right out and said before they did it, "I think it's wrong to establish districts that are overwhelmingly one ethnicity or another just to avoid the other, just to create appropriate representation. Like, I think it's unlawful to make white people in charge of every district." He didn't say that, but that's what he did. So he was doing something to help all the white people in Florida. And we ended up with two less African Americans, and one of the black representatives in Congress happened to be a Republican. So he was okay. His name is Donald. He was in his second term nominated to be Speaker of the House. He thinks he's, you know, the next governor of Florida, by the way. And so he let that district stand because he was a Republican, a real right-wing Republican. And that's what we did in 2022. It took Charlie Crist. That's why he ran for governor, because it took away his district and gave it to some woman named Luna Pick, and took away a district over in Orlando and created another one. And so what they did is, so this, their case is still pending in front of the 11th Circuit, just like the Alabama case was. And what this case means for Florida and North Carolina and South Carolina, that they're now going to have to go through redistricting to establish the kind of racial balance that currently, as interpreted, Section 2 requires. So that's the import of this case in a practical sense. In a political sense, it's devastating because it's another loss for Ron DeSantis, or DeSantis, depending on how he's pronouncing it this week. So it's a real problem politically for Republicans, because Republicans in Congress are counting on those states to produce their majority. If they now have to create districts which will now turn over to Democrats, they're going to lose the House. That's how important this is. That's politically how important this is. As far as the court is concerned, this is a sign, the way it was passed, because it was done with the three women liberals, Roberts and Kavanaugh. Kavanaugh is now going to become, with Roberts, a combination Kennedy. And Kavanaugh, who will always stay to the right of center, has moved from a radical right winger and starting to move his pendulum back towards the middle now. Now, he'll never make it all the way to the middle. He might, but I don't think he will. But this also gave me evidence that the story that Kavanaugh was getting ready to change his vote on Dobbs to create a plurality decision that would not have overruled Roe, but would have sustained the Louisiana statute, is true. And it adds to the additional that the person who actually leaked the Dobbs opinion looks at himself every day in the mirror. This is the guy who says, I know exactly who it was. That person looks at himself every day in the mirror. And I'm talking about Sam Alito, because he did it before with the Hobby Lobby case. He leaked his opinion. And he did it to corner Kavanaugh, because you notice that draft opinion said who was concurring, and Kavanaugh's name was there, and Kavanaugh didn't want to look like he was changing his mind. He didn't like, and he was cornered into continuing to sustain his belief in the majority opinion. Alito's lost him. Alito and Thomas can't control him anymore. And I think we're going to see more of this type of opinion coming from him when he can go with Roberts. He won't do it on his own. He's not that confident. But he will do it if Roberts says this is what we need to do. And we'll have plurality opinions which will have no precedential value. It will decide who wins and loses that lawsuit, but that's all it will do. So I think there are breadcrumbs in that case that people have to start reading. And it's really important. So, you know, that's what I see in this case. And I see a Democratic majority in the House of Representatives in 2024.
Really?
I really do. I see them taking I think it'll be a substantial majority. And if it's a complete Democratic sweep, Republicans will have to decide whether they ever want to win an election again. And it could be that bad. It could be a blue wave.
Yeah, to that.
And I said, yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead.
And to that point, I something I wanted to sort of talk about. We only got 2 minutes left, but
we got more time if you need it.
Yeah, I don't have much time, but I got stuff going on. But I just wanted to mention.
Go ahead.
What's that?
I said I don't even have enough time to breathe. So go ahead.
Yeah. Right. I got But I look at the two front runners for the Republican nomination, Donald Trump, and this is starting to catch up. Excuse me. People are starting to say about Ron DeSantis what, you know, we've been saying and you've been saying for a long time, which is the more you get to know this guy, the more you don't like him. And I'm looking at the two of them, who between the two of them are the most dour, down, angry, hateful politicians, you know, among the two worst in the entire country. And I was thinking back, you remember It's Morning in America? Remember that?
Yep.
That, you know, so filled with optimism, so in love with the country, you know, so I think, you know, Morning in America, you know, Ronald Reagan's big theme, you know, affable. You know, Ronald Reagan, everything he did, I think just about everything he did was wrong politically. But he was an affable guy, got along fine with Tip O'Neill. I mean, you know, everybody, you know, all is right with the world. Then we have George H.W. Bush and his 1,000 points of light, right? Very optimistic about Americans and the American people and 1,000 points of light. And even his son, George W., at least put on a show of trying to say, you know, kinder, gentler Republican Party and Conservative Party. And I look, I compare that, again, not that any of that was really, you know, true, but at least there was a front. And I'm beginning to wonder, how are Americans going to respond to a Ron DeSantis? So let's say that Trump just does become so much of a problem for the party that they dump him, and you're stuck with Ron DeSantis. Where is his message about mourning in America or 1,000 points of light or a kinder and gentler conservative movement? I mean, all he is angry and mean and nasty.
And a bully.
Yeah, and I don't know what you think about it, but it seems to me that the more exposure he gets, you know, the less likely it is that he'll win a general election. I don't know what you think about that.
Well, I think that, and this led me into something that I'm just going to allude to, but I want to talk about more next week, is a study that was done in regards to the 2018 elections and 20 and 22 and younger voters. The younger voters are turning out in numbers that we've never seen before. And they strongly back Democratic candidates because they don't like the battle that Republicans have with you know, secularization and political correctness and illegal immigration and all the things that they want to deal with fear. Many younger voters have become politically active because they have a fear for the country's future in the right terms. They have a fear that all of these things that Republicans are talking about are going to destroy the country. And what literally seems to be driving voters to the polls, younger voters, isn't love, but anger. And that comes out of the Cook Political Report, a woman by the name of Amy Walter put together. I think we need to talk about this more maybe next week because there's a lot to it. And younger voters who are demanding younger candidates, and I can understand that. I liked John Kennedy when I was a kid because he was only 40 years old. But I think it's something we really do need to talk about. But what it fits in with what you were just saying. The younger people want optimism. They do not want to be dragged down to things that they don't believe in by fear. And their fear is different than the fear of basically white Americans. They don't have white power, white supremacy, white privilege fears that their parents do and that carry them to people like Donald Trump. Even though they claim they're not racist, they are. So we need to talk about that in greater detail. There's a lot of articles regarding this, and I think we should talk about it next week and set some time aside for it. But, yeah. What you're saying is accurate. Voters want optimism. They want to be told what their life is going to be like. What are you going to do for me? Don't tell me what you don't like. Tell me what you're going to do for me. And they're not getting that from Republican candidates for the most part. Everybody wants to tell them their lives are miserable, and they're sitting there saying, my life is getting better. What are you talking about? So we'll see what happens. But that's kind of where everybody is. We are out of time. We are over.
Yep. All right.
I enjoy today.
Thanks, gentlemen.
And Hezzy, thank you very much for having us again. I appreciate it, and you take care of yourself. And Brendan, I'll see you around campus. How's that sound?
Yeah, see you soon. And thanks, Hezzy. We'll see you next week.
Okay.
Thank you both.
Take care, Hezzy. Have a good day, everybody. We'll talk to you next week.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
Sounds good. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Look forward to both of you gentlemen on the air next week. Always a pleasure, always a learning experience. I don't know about you, but that's how I feel. I learn so much. It's so intuitive and so clear. fantastic. Anyway, we're going to move on to different issues, so bear with me a moment here. We're going to move on to what's happening on the international stage. And we'll start off with what's happening in the Ukraine, because we're going to give you an update of what's happening in the Ukraine. Bear with me a second here. It seems that no ground has been lost in a counterattack in Ukraine, so says Kiev. Well, Ukraine's president promised Ukrainian flags would soon fly over Russia-occupied territory in the south and east. Meanwhile, Prague, the capital of Czechoslovakia, is renaming a street due to the war, affecting some 5,000 residents. Well, this is the latest information. Kyiv has lost no terrain amid a counteroffensive launched recently to regain territories occupied by Russia since its invasion, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said today. Well, Zelensky added during his nightly address that Ukrainian warriors, quote-unquote, were defending positions in certain areas while resisting Russian assaults in others. Quote, we have no lost positions, only liberated ones. They have only losses, he said. The president promised that Ukrainian flags would soon be flying, quote, all over our south and all over our east, end quote. He thanked the fighters involved in the ongoing counteroffensive, quote, for each liberated and each defended position, end quote. Meanwhile, Ukrainian Deputy Defense Minister Hanna Maryar acknowledged the difficulty faced by Kyiv in its counteroffensive, but maintained that the, quote, biggest blow, end quote, was yet to come. Maryar said in a Telegram post that the Ukrainian military was moving forward as planned. Quote, the enemy will not easily give up their positions, and we must prepare ourselves for a tough duel, she added. In fact, she continues, that is what is happening right now. Ukraine is believed to have launched its long-awaited counteroffensive 2 weeks ago. Following months of preparations, it hopes to reclaim nearly a fifth of its land now under Moscow occupation. And now we move on to some other things. Is the Ukrainian counteroffensive the last chance for victory? Here are some of the developments concerning Russia's war in Ukraine as of today. The European Union proposes €50 billion package to support Ukraine. Ukraine is to receive €50 billion, that's $54.65 billion in loans and grants from the European Union for the year 2024 to 2027 under plans presented by the European Commission in Brussels. For the financial aid aims to provide perspective and predictability to Ukraine, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen advised journalists. The long-term package is to allow the European Union to adapt, quote, financial support according to the evolution of the situation on the ground, end quote, as Russia's war in Ukraine, quote, requires utmost flexibility, end quote, from Brussels, von der Leyen had said. Well, the new financial support is subject to the approval of the European Union's 27 member states and the European Parliament. Scholz is calling on China to use its influence over Russia in Ukraine. After German-Chinese government consultations in Berlin, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz said he appealed to the Chinese government to exert its influence on Russia over Moscow's war with Ukraine. As a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council, China has, quote, a very special task, end quote, Scholz had said. He stressed that it is important that Beijing continues not to supply weapons, quote, to the aggressor Russia, end quote. Scholz stressed that Ukraine's right to territorial integrity and sovereignty and, quote, peaceful coexistence worldwide is based on this rule, a rule based on international order not in the power of the strongest, end quote. No country should regard other countries as their backyard and try to shift borders by force, he said. Quote, imperialism is never the solution. A Russian soldier gets 11,000 euros for destroying a German tank. A Russian soldier who destroyed a German-made Leopard tank in a battle in Ukraine has been given a 1 million ruble, that's 10,820 euros, rewarded by a private foundation, Russia's defense ministry had said. It published a video showing the soldier sitting on a hospital bed and receiving a reward certificate from Alexander Karelin, a three-time Olympic champion in Greco-Roman wrestling. The ministry did not say when and where the soldier had destroyed the tank or what he was being treated for in hospital. In the video, he appeared to be missing his right hand. Russia says its forces have destroyed a number of German-made Leopards and U.S.-supplied Bradley fighting vehicles since Ukraine launched a counteroffensive earlier this month. The United Nations is going to support small and medium-sized companies to rebuild Ukraine. Supporting small and medium-sized enterprises is one of the next goals in the reconstruction of Ukraine, according to the United Nations. Much economic recovery can be achieved with financial startup aid. Achim Steiner, the head of the United Nations Development Agency, UNDP, said in Geneva, Switzerland, quote, the order of magnitude is breathtaking and will continue to grow, end quote, he said the day before the second reconstruction conference is to start in London. The Ukraine Recovery Conference is due to bring together 1,000 foreign dignitaries from 61 states, along with business chiefs and global investors. The construction conference took place a year ago in Lugano, Switzerland. Russia says Ukraine plan missile strikes on Crimea. Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu said that Ukraine was planning to attack Moscow-controlled Crimea with HIMARS long-range artillery systems and Storm Shadow missiles and warned that Russia would retaliate. Such strikes, which Russia considers to be outside the area of what it calls its, quote, special military operation, end quote, in Ukraine, would also mean full-scale involvement of the United States and Britain in the conflict, Shoigu had said. Well, Ukraine is using German Gepard tanks to defend its skies. Russia seized and annexed the Ukrainian peninsula of Crimea in 2014. The illegal annexation was not recognized by Ukraine and most countries in the world. Biden says that the threat of Putin using tactical nuclear weapons is, quote, real, end quote. U.S. President Joe Biden said the threat of Russian President Vladimir Putin using tactical nuclear weapons is, quote, real, end quote, days after denouncing Russia's deployment of such weapons in Belarus. Quote, when I was out here about 2 years ago saying I worried about the Colorado River drying up, everybody looked at me like I was crazy, Biden told a group of donors in California. Quote, they looked at me like when I said, I worry about Putin using tactical nuclear weapons. It's real, Biden said. On Saturday, Biden called Putin's announcement that Russia had deployed its first tactical nuclear weapons to Belarus, quote, absolutely irresponsible, end quote. Well, Russia launches massive overnight drone attack on Ukraine. Russian forces launched a widespread drone attack overnight in the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv and other cities from east to west, Ukrainian officials said, although no immediate casualties were reported. The Kyiv City Military Administration said this was the first attack in 18 days on the city to use Iranian-made Shahed explosive drones. Quote, according to the usual tactics for mass UAV attacks, drones entered the Capitol in waves, heading from different directions. The air alert lasted more than 3 hours, it said on Telegram. 24 enemy targets were detected and destroyed by the forces and means of our air defense in the airspace around Kyiv. That's end quote. Most of the country spent the night with air raid sirens blaring for hours, according to preliminary information given by the General Staff of Ukraine's Armed Forces. He later said that 30 drones were launched by Russian forces, of which 28 were shot down by Ukrainian air defenses. The military administration of Lviv, about 43 miles from the border with NATO member Poland, said that Russia hit, quote, critical infrastructure, end quote, in the city, sparking a fire. So far, no casualties have been reported. Yuri Malashko, the head of the military administration of the Zaporizhia region in southeastern Ukraine, said on Telegram that a number of Russian missiles had targeted telecommunication infrastructure and agricultural properties. The reports of damage could not be independently verified. Russia has not commented on the latest attacks. Ukraine says that Hungary is ignoring requests for contacting prisoners of war. Well, Ukraine has accused the Hungarian government of ignoring its request to contact Ukrainian prisoners of war, Kyiv claims, had been secretly transferred from Russia. Quote, all attempts by Ukrainian diplomats over recent days to establish direct contact with Ukrainian citizens have failed, end quote, Ukraine's foreign ministry spokesperson Oleg Nikolenko said on his Facebook page. Quote, this, as well as information received from the relatives of some of them, indicates that the Hungarian authorities' assurances of the alleged free status of Ukrainian defenders in Hungary are not true, he added. Budapest said on June 9 that it had received 11 Ukrainian prisoners of war from Russia. Hungarian and international media quoted the Hungarian president's chief of staff as saying that the soldiers arrived in Hungary, quote, on their own free will, end quote, and they could, quote, freely, end quote, leave. Quote, we do not check or monitor them, chief of staff Gergely Gulyas was quoted as saying. Hungary is a member of the European Union, had enjoyed strong ties with Moscow before the war, and it did not sever them after Russia invaded Ukraine in February of 2022. Further, we have that Paris and Rome are supplying Ukraine with SAMP/T air defense system. Ukraine is currently relying on the SAMP/T air defense system supplied by France and Italy to defend itself against Moscow amid the ongoing battles, French President Emmanuel Macron said late on Monday. While the system, jointly developed in France and Italy since the start of the century, defends against aircraft and missiles. Kyiv was relying on it to protect key facilities and human lives, Macron had said. Further words, we find that Prague has renamed a street to impact some 5,000 residents. Some 5,000 residents of the 3.4-kilometer long, or roughly 2.11 miles, street in the Czech capital are bracing for a paperwork headache after the government decided to rename a street due to the Russian war on Ukraine. The Ivan Stepanovich Korniv Street, named after the Soviet general, will be renamed Hatigova as of October, a spokesman for the city council announced on Monday. Residents will be obliged to change their identity cards and other documents within 6 months to reflect their new address. In April of 2020, Prague disposed of a massive statue of Korniv, which was placed in the capital's Inter-Brigade Square, much to the ire of Moscow. Russia at the time branded it an, quote, act of vandalism, end quote. Ivan Stepanovich Korniv is credited for liberating Prague from Nazi rule during the end of World War II. Unbelievable. Now we hear from Germany. Stoltenberg said summit won't invite Ukraine to join NATO. Speaking alongside German Chancellor Olaf Scholz in Berlin, the NATO chief said that alliance's upcoming summit in Vilnius will not result in a formal invitation for Ukraine to become a member. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz met with NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg in Berlin on Monday. The talks focused on the upcoming NATO summit, scheduled to take place on July 11 to 12 in the Lithuanian capital of Vilnius. Some people remember it as Vilna, but it's known as Vilnius. The summit will largely be focused on the Russian war of aggression in Ukraine. Ukrainian officials have repeatedly said they expect a signal of readiness to subsequently accept Ukraine as a member of the alliance. However, the NATO countries have not agreed on an official invitation to Ukraine to join. So there's no formal invitation for Ukraine in Vilnius. In Berlin, Stoltenberg confirmed that the NATO summit would not result in a formal invitation for Ukraine to join the alliance. Quote, at the Vilnius summit and in the preparation for the summit, we are not discussing to issue a formal invitation, end quote, he told reporters after meeting Scholz. He added, however, that leaders would talk about how to move Ukraine closer to NATO. At the same time, Stoltenberg warned against accepting a frozen conflict in Ukraine in return for an end to the war. Quote, we all want this war to end, but a just peace cannot mean freezing the conflict and accepting a deal dictated by Russia, he said. Meanwhile, Scholz said that Germany is prepared for the possibility that the war in Ukraine could still last for a while. Quote, we are preparing for that and adjusting our policies based on that, end quote, he said, adding that Germany would continue to support Ukraine for as long as necessary. So what else is on the agenda of the Vilnius summit? Stoltenberg earlier said he expected leaders at the NATO summit to agree on a pledge to spend at least 2% of the gross domestic product on defense in the future. A decision to extend Stoltenberg's term in office until the NATO anniversary summit in July of 2024 in Washington is also likely to be made in Vilnius. The German government and other member states have already spoken out in favor of the 64-year-old Norwegian remaining in office. Last week, Stoltenberg was in the United States for talks with U.S. President Joe Biden and Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Now, let's look at what's going on with regard to China and Germany. Evidently, it's a balancing act. The latest round of high-level government consultations in Berlin were friendly in tone, but tough in substance. Germany needs China, but also wants to minimize its dependency. Chinese Premier Li Qian came to Berlin with 10 of his cabinet ministers. He was received by Germany's head of state, President Frank-Walter Steinmeier, and then by its head of government, Chancellor Olaf Scholz, and 9 federal ministers. At least in terms of the size of the delegation, these intergovernmental consultations were no different from those the German government has held in recent months with India and Japan, with Spain and the Netherlands, but that is where the similarities end. Relations between Berlin and Beijing have deteriorated in recent years. Whether it is Beijing's, quote, rock-solid friendship, end quote, with Moscow, despite Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the growing tensions in the Taiwan Strait, or the repression of the Uyghur minority in China, the number of disagreements is growing and is further intensified by the geopolitical rivalry between China and the United States' symbiotic relationship. Still, China is and remains Germany's most important trading partner, ahead of the United States. In the last 10 years, the exchange of goods with China has practically doubled to around 3 600 billion euros, that's $327 billion. The full contradictory nature of the relationship can be seen in the fact that official German documents now regularly refer to China as a partner, competitor, and strategic rival all at the same time. A German government consultation with China began in 2011, initially emphasizing the partnership. In 2014, the relationship was even elevated to the status of a, quote, comprehensive strategic partnership, but since then, the mood has turned. Quote, we need to examine how sustainable the format of government consultations with China still is, which is actually only intended for particularly close strategic value partners, end quote, Michael Roth from Chancellor Scholz's center-left Social Democratic Party, the SPD, and the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the federal parliament, the Bundestag, said. Well, Michael Roth from Chancellor Scholz's center-left Social Democratic Party probably pronounces his name as Michael Roth, which is a German way of pronouncing it. Well, there's no decoupling, but rather de-risking. Scholz is more diplomatic. Quote, de-risking, yes. Decoupling, no. He says, describing his position, which he shares with the major Western industrialized nations, quote, we have no interest in economic decoupling from China, Scholz reiterated after talks with Li Qian in Berlin. Let's continue the dialogue to understand each other well and face global challenges together, Scholz said, addressing Li Qian. He said it was, quote, a special concern, end quote, for the German government that Germany and China work closely together in the fight against climate change. The two countries are among the largest emitters of greenhouse gases and therefore bear a particularly large responsibility in the fight against global warming, he said. Well, China's premier Li Qian described the government's consultations as, quote, practical and highly effective, end quote, and spoke of a, quote, fruitful result, end quote. 10 joint projects were agreed upon, he said. Among them was a three-year action plan for regular exchanges in areas such as climate and species protection and the fight against hunger and pandemics. Two countries had exchanged views, quote, quite openly and in depth, said Li Qian, who again agreed to put cooperation forward, quote, for mutual benefit, end quote, despite all differences. The two countries should look for common ground and, quote, work hand in hand to help each other succeed, end quote, he said. Quote, if we strengthen cooperation in science, industry, and business, we will contribute to the stability of the world economy, he said. But Germany has become wary of cooperation with China. German companies are in the process of reducing dependencies. Quote, companies are intensively diversifying their sales and procurement markets strategically and building new partnerships, end quote, to Siegfried Rustwurm, the president of the Federation of German Industry, the BDI. The German company's special plans for China. Nevertheless, China remains an exceedingly important market. More than 5,000 German companies with 1.1 million employees produce in the People's Republic. In addition to the big names such as Volkswagen and BASF, these also include countless medium-sized companies. They all benefit from cheap labor and China's huge domestic market. The European Union is developing concrete proposals for tougher action against China. For the German economy, this sounds alarming, but the Chancellor has been taking pains to reassure business leaders. A major gathering this week, he emphasized the only business deals in the area of defense and armaments would have to be scrutinized very carefully. Meanwhile, the German business community is already preparing for a degree of, quote, decoupling, end quote. Many have made plans to split companies into two separate business units, one for China and one for the rest of the world. The China division, one second here. One second. I lost my place here. Okay, so meanwhile, the German business community is already preparing for a degree of decoupling, quote unquote, and many have made plans to split companies into two separate businesses. And the China division would then produce only for the Chinese market and become a purely Chinese company. So some U.S. companies are also already planning to do this as well. So that's what needs to be known. Let me just quickly look, see what else we need to look into here. It's about 11:31 now, local time. Let's look at some issues. A record 110 million people worldwide are now forcibly displaced, says the United Nations. The world is failing to protect civilians, according to conflicts, the United Nations chief says. So let's look at what's going on the world stage. Several have been shot dead near the West Bank settlement, Israeli medics say. Four people were shot dead on Tuesday near the settlement in the occupied West Bank, Israeli officials said, a day after an army raid left six Palestinians dead. Israel's Magen David Adom, the emergency services, which is like our losing my mind because all I can remember in my mind is Magen David Adom. This is ambulances. Emergency services announced four confirmed deceased by its medics, while four others were wounded. Magen David Adom spokesperson was not immediately able to confirm the nationalities of those killed when contacted by Agence France-Presse, while the identity of the assailants was not immediately known. The Israeli military said, quote, a civilian in the area neutralized one of the terrorists, end quote, without giving further details on their condition, and troops had launched a manhunt for other suspects. The Office of Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said that security officials will meet at a local time, 6 p.m. Local time. The shooting comes a day after Israeli forces launched a raid in the West Bank city of Jenin, in which six Palestinians were killed. A spokesman for the Palestinian military group Hamas, Hazem Hassin, described Tuesday's shooting at a petrol or gasoline station as a, quote, response to the crimes of the Israeli occupation, end quote, in Jenin and elsewhere. The sixth Jenin fatality, Amjad Aref Ja'as, died on Tuesday, quote, from critical wounds to the abdomen sustained from live occupation or Israeli fire, a Palestinian health ministry statement had said, where more than 90 Palestinians were wounded in the hours-long raid, according to health officials, while the Israeli military said eight security personnel were wounded. Ja'as's body was shrouded in a Palestinian flag in a Jenin mosque before dozens of mourners, including masked gunmen, gathered for his funeral. Well, after the firefight between Israeli forces and Palestinian militants ended on Monday, the Palestinian Health Ministry announced Israeli troops killed a 20-year-old near the West Bank city of Bethlehem. Zakaria Mohammed al-Zaoul was, quote, martyred by a live occupation, Israeli occupation bullets to the head in the town of Husan, the ministry had said. Well, the Israeli military said the troops were, quote, on routine activity in the town when a suspect, quote, unquote, suspect hurled Molotov cocktails at them, end quote. Well, the soldiers responded with live fire. A hit was identified, he added. In a statement, the militant group Islamic Jihad claims Zaoul as a member. The official Palestinian news agency Wafa reported the military used live fire, tear gas, and stun grenades during the clashes with young Palestinians. The deaths are the latest in a surge of violence linked to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which before Tuesday's shooting had killed at least 166 Palestinians, 21 Israelis, a Ukrainian, and an Italian this year. So the tally compiled from official sources includes combatants as well as civilians on the Israeli side, three members of the Arab minority. Tens of thousands of protesters in the occupied West Bank marks the 75 years since the catastrophe or the Nakba. Thousands from across the occupied West Bank demonstrated on yesterday, waving Palestinian flags to mark the 75th anniversary of the Nakba, which it translates from the Arabic to catastrophe, which they associate with Israel's creation. According to the United Nations, more than 760,000 Palestinians fled or were expelled from their homes in 1948. In Ramallah, the seat of the Palestinian Authority, protesters carried black banners that read "Return," quote unquote, and also raised images of old keys, the symbol of the Palestinians' plight and demand for recognition of their right to return. Commemoration of the Nakba this year comes during heightened tensions in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which has claimed more than 170 lives on both sides since the start of the year. 35 people, almost all of them Palestinian, were killed during 5 days of fighting between Israel and armed groups in the blockaded Gaza Strip last week. Israel was established on May 14, 1948, following a United Nations vote in November of 1947 that divided the British mandate for Palestine into a Jewish and an Arab state. A day after Israel declared statehood, 5 Arab armies attacked the young nation. In the war that ensued, Israel defeated the Arab forces. During the conflict, more than 600 communities were destroyed or depopulated by Jewish forces, according to the Israeli organization Zohot. Now, Palestinians have since demanded a return, a right to return, which Israel has steadfastly denied, claiming it would be tantamount to a demographic surrender of the state's Jewish nature. According to the United Nations, there are now 5.9 million Palestinians refugees living in the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria. Israel celebrated 75th Independence Day on April 26, according to the Jewish calendar. Respect international resolutions. For the first time, the United Nations commemorated Nakba at its headquarters in New York on Monday after a resolution was passed in November. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, whose state of Palestine, quote-unquote, has United Nations observer status, spoke in Arabic at a special session of the Committee on the Exercise of the Inalienable Rights of the Palestinian People. Quote, we demand today, officially, in accordance with the international law, with international law and international resolutions, to make sure that Israel respects these resolutions or suspend Israel's membership of the United Nations, Abbas had said, referring to hundreds of UN resolutions over the years that Palestinians view as guaranteeing their rights. During the hour-long speech, he said that Nakba, quote, did not start in 1948 and it did not stop after that date, end quote. Quote, Israel, the occupying power, continues its occupation and its aggression against the Palestinian people and continues to deny this Nakba and rejects international resolutions regarding the return of Palestinian refugees to their homeland, end quote. Continues, he says, not a number, end quote. Back in Ramallah, 64-year-old Khairi Hanun, dressed in a traditional Palestinian costume, was carrying an old suitcase and an old key symbolizing the displacement of 1948. Quote, we are here to tell the occupation by Israel that it was what it was like and that it was like this and that they have chased away our parents and grandparents only with the clothes on their back, said Hunan, a resident of Tulham in the northwestern or the northern West Bank. So within Israel, about 2 million people, more than 20% of the population of Palestinians and their descendants who remained there are after the state was founded. Community of Arab Israelis, and Israel, as Israelis call them, was also represented at the gathering in Ramallah. One of the biggest or greatest mistakes committed by the Zionist movement was that between 150,000 and 160,000 Palestinians remained in Israel after the Nakba, said Mohammed Baraka. We are almost 2 million, and we are not a number, but a testament to the national identity Israel had tried to erase, Baraka said. Nohad Wahdani, whose family lived through the Nakba, said that, quote, these commemorations are organized every year so that young people can learn their history and not forget it. One second. Okay, I think we're good here. Bear with me a moment. All right, bear with me a second here. Move on to the next screen. Let's find my way. Let me just quickly see here. Let's look at what else is going on the world stage. One second. This is what we know about the missing Titanic tourist submersible. The search and rescue teams, or rather search and rescue teams, are racing to find a deep sea vessel that went missing with five people on board during a dive to explore the wreck of the Titanic ocean liner. The U.S. Coast Guard is leading the search for the small craft named Titan in the North Atlantic Ocean. The remote area is where the Titanic struck an iceberg and sank in 1912, killing all but about 700 of the roughly 2,200 passengers and crew. The Titan's dive on Sunday is one of many that have been made to the wreck by Ocean Gate Expedition since 2021. The sunken ship is about 2.4 miles below the surface. The undersea exploration company has been chronicling the ship's decay as well as the underwater ecosystem that has sprung up around it over the last century. Here's what we know so far. When and where did the Titan go missing? It seems that the craft submerged on Sunday morning and its support vessel lost contact with it about an hour and 45 minutes later, according to the Coast Guard. The vessel was reported overdue about 700 kilometers south of St. John's, Newfoundland, according to Canada's Joint Rescue Coordination Center in Halifax, Nova Scotia. The Titan was launched from an icebreaker that was hired by Ocean Gate and formerly operated by the Canadian Coast Guard. The ship ferried dozens of people and the submersible craft to the North Atlantic wreck site where the Titan makes multiple dives. David Concannon, an advisor to Ocean Gate, told the Associated Press on Monday that the submersible had a 96-hour oxygen supply. He said officials are working to get a remotely operated vehicle that can reach a depth of 6 kilometers to the site as soon as possible. So who's on board? Well, the Coast Guard said that there are one pilot and four mission specialists, quote-unquote, aboard. Mission specialists are people who pay to come along on Ocean Gate's expedition. They take turns operating sonar equipment and performing other tasks in the five-person submersible. UK businessman Hamish Harding is one of the mission specialists, according to Action Aviation the company for which Harding serves as chairman. Harding is an adventurer who holds 3 Guinness World Records, including the longest duration at full ocean depth by a crewed vessel. In March of 2021, he and ocean explorer Victor Vescovo dived to the lowest depth of the Mariana Trench. In June of 2022, he went into space on Blue Origin's New Shepard rocket. So what kind of deep sea vessel is it? Titan is capable of diving 4 kilometers with a comfortable safety margin, end quote. According to documents filed by the company in April in a U.S. District Court in Virginia that oversees Titanic matters. In a May 2021 court filing, OceanGate said that Titan had an, quote, unparalleled safety feature, end quote, that assesses the integrity of the hull throughout every dive. At the time of the filing, Titan had undergone more than 50 test dives, including to the equivalent depths of the Titanic in deep waters off the Bahamas and in a pressure chamber, the company had said. So during the 2022 expedition, OceanGate reported that the submersible had a battery issue on its first dive and had to be manually attached to its lifting platform, according to a November court filing. So what is the Titan's mission? Well, the goal of OceanGate's expedition has been to chronicle the Titanic's deterioration as well as the underwater ecosystem that shipwrecks often spawn. What's left of the Titanic is slowly succumbing to metal-eating bacteria that consume hundreds of pounds of iron a day. Holes pervade the wreckage, while the crow's nest is already gone. Some have predicted the ship could vanish in a matter of decades as holes yawn in the hull and sections disintegrate. The company outfitted the Titan with high-definition cameras and multi-beam sonar equipment. Charting the wreck's decomposition can help scientists predict the fate of other deep-sea wrecks, including those that sank during the World Wars. Another focus is the sea life. Hundreds of species have only been seen in the wreck or at the wreck. The ocean is taking this in, and we need to document it before it all disappears or becomes unrecognizable. Stockton Rush, the president of OceanGate Expeditions, advised the Associated Press back in 2021. Okay, now let's just see what else is going on. One second here. All right. One second. All right, one second. And this is important news. I don't know if you remember Daniel Ellsberg, I do. He is the Pentagon Papers whistleblower who exposed Vietnam War secrets. He died at 92. Daniel Ellsberg, a U.S. military analyst whose change of heart on the Vietnam War led him to leak the classified, quote, Pentagon Papers, end quote, revealing U.S. government deception about the war and setting off a major freedom of the press battle, died on Friday at the age of 92, his family said in a statement. Ellsberg, who had been diagnosed with inoperable pancreatic cancer in February, died at his home in Kensington, California, the family had said. Long before Edward Snowden and WikiLeaks were revealing government secrets in the name of transparency, Ellsberg let Americans know that their government was capable of misleading and even lying to them. In his later years, Ellsberg would become an advocate for whistleblowers and leakers. Pentagon Papers leak was portrayed in the 2017 movie The Post. Ellsberg secretly went to the media in 1971 in hopes of expediting the end of the Vietnam War. It made him the target of a smear campaign by the Nixon White House. Henry Kissinger, who was then the president's national security advisor, referred to him as, quote, the most dangerous man in America who must be stopped at all costs, end quote. When he went to Saigon for the State Department in the mid-1960s, Ellsberg had an impressive resume. He had earned 3 degrees from Harvard, served in the Marine Corps, and worked at the Pentagon and the RAND Corporation, the influential policy research think tank. He was a dedicated Cold War warrior and hawk on Vietnam at the time, but Ellsberg, in his 2003 book, Secrets, a Memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers, end quote, said he was only 1 week into a two-year tour of duty in Saigon when he realized the United States was in a war it would not win. Meanwhile, at the behest of Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, Pentagon officials had secretly been putting together a 7,000-page report covering U.S. involvement in Vietnam from 1945 through 1967. When it was finished in 1969, two of the 15 published copies went to the RAND Corporation, where Ellsberg was once again working. My dear father, hashtag Daniel Ellsberg, died this morning, June 16th, at 1:24 in the morning, 4 months after his diagnosis with pancreatic cancer. His family surrounded him. As he took his last breath, he had no pain and died peacefully at home. So wrote Robert Ellsberg on June 16th. With his new perspectives on the war, Ellsberg started attending peace rallies. He said he was inspired to copy the, quote, Pentagon Papers, end quote, after hearing an anti-war protester say he was looking forward to going to prison for resisting the draft. Ellsberg began sneaking the top secret study out of the RAND office and copying it at night on a rented Xerox machine, using his 13-year-old son and 10-year-old daughter as helpers. He took the documents with him when he moved to Boston for a job at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, and ended up sitting on them for a year and a half before passing pages to the New York Times. The Times ran its first installment of the Pentagon Papers on June 13th of 1971, and the administration, President Richard Nixon, moved quickly to get a judge to stop further publication. Nixon's claim of executive authority and invocation of the Espionage Act set off a freedom of the press fight over the extreme censorship of prior restraint. Ellsberg's next move was to give the Pentagon Papers to the Washington Post and more than a dozen other newspapers. In the New York Times versus U.S., the Supreme Court ruled less than 3 weeks after first publication that the press had the right to publish the papers, and the Times resumed doing so. The study said that the U.S. officials had concluded that the war probably could not be won and that President John F. Kennedy approved the plans for a coup to overthrow the South Vietnamese leader. It also said that Kennedy's successor, Lyndon Baines Johnson, had plans to expand the war, including bombing in North Vietnam, despite saying during the 1964 campaign that he would not. The papers also revealed the secret U.S. bombing in Cambodia and Laos, and that casualty figures were higher than reported on the run. The Times never said who leaked the papers, but the FBI quickly figured it out. Ellsberg remained underground for about 2 weeks before surrendering in Boston. Quote, I felt that as an American citizen, as a responsible citizen, I could no longer cooperate in concealing this information from the American public, Ellsberg said at the time. Quote, I did this clearly at my own jeopardy, and I am prepared to answer to all the consequences of this decision, end quote. He would say that he regretted not leaking the papers sooner. Even though the Pentagon Papers did not cover Nixon's handling of Vietnam, the White House's plumbers unit, which would later pull off the Watergate break-in that led to Nixon's downfall, was ordered to stop further leaks and discredit Ellsberg. 2.5 months after first publication, two men who later figured prominently in Watergate, D. Gordon Liddy and E. Howard Hunt, broke into the office of Ellsberg's psychiatrist to search for incriminating evidence. Ellsberg and a Rand colleague were eventually charged with espionage, theft, and conspiracy, but in their 1973 trial, the case was dismissed on the grounds of government misconduct when the break-in was revealed. In later years, Ellsberg, who was born April 7, 1931 in Chicago, Illinois, became a writer and lecturer in the campaign for government transparency and against the proliferation of nuclear weapons. He said that Snowden, a contractor for the National Security Agency who gave journalists thousands of classified documents on government information gathering before fleeing the country, had done nothing wrong. He also said he considered Army Private Chelsea Manning a hero for turning over a trove of government files to WikiLeaks. When I spoke with Dan 1 month ago, who knew well how few grains of sand remained in his glass, he assessed the risk of a nuclear exchange to be escalating beyond 10%. He had hoped to dedicate its final hours to reducing it for all those he would leave behind, a hero to the end. So said Edward Snowden back in June 16th of 2023. So that's the story. Take care and be well.